Anybody who ever felt low, really low, may wonder just what good it does to either themselves or the world to be so depressed that they can't get out of bed. Well, today's guest says it could be an evolutionary adaptation. Your first thought might be, gee, thanks, evolution, but bear with us as we explore just what the value of depression might have been to our survival as a species. Jonathan Rottenberg's book is The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Jonathan Rottenberg is an associate professor of psychology at the University of South Florida and the director of the Mood and Emotion Laboratory there. Dr. Rottenberg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You get the self-revelation out right up front. You have been on both sides of treatment, I understand.
That's right. Before I wrote the book, I was studying to be a historian, and I experienced a severe depression that nearly took my life.
And at that point, saw treatment. Which, did that really turn your career around in addition to your life getting treatment?
It was a profound experience. I realized that history didn't seem so relevant anymore. I had to understand what had happened to me, how moods can go wrong, and I changed careers at that point and went back to school to become a research psychologist. That was about 20 years ago.
And it's interesting, you're the director of the Mood and Emotion Laboratory. What goes on at the Mood and Emotion Laboratory at the University of South Florida?
We're trying to understand how depression affects our moods and emotions. And it turns out that there's a variety of ways that moods and emotions are different in depression than they are in people who are healthy.
You mean just the general run of emotions is just that different for somebody experiencing depression?
Well, we actually do laboratory studies, for example, and we expose people to films and other situations that elicit emotions, and then we examine how depression alters what people experience, what behaviors they report, and what's going on in their bodies. We also do field studies, so following people in everyday life in measuring their emotional experiences and the situations that they're in, and again, trying to understand how depression systematically changes both how emotion is experienced and in what contexts it's experienced.
Your devotion to dealing with depression extends to the creation of something called the Come Out of the Dark campaign. Tell us what that is.
Sure. So my book is one important means for having a new conversation about depression. Depression, despite it being a very common condition, is a condition that people don't find very easy to talk about. And so in addition to the book, I've started this campaign called Come Out of the Dark, and people can write me, and I'm sending, and I would certainly send to your listeners, a free glow-in-the-dark bracelet that says Come Out of the Dark on it. And one thing that's a bit unique about it is that in addition to receiving a bracelet, we're having people return pictures of themselves wearing the bracelets. And it's sort of unusual because normally depression is such a toxic and taboo subject that people who have had depression in themselves or in their families are kind of standing tall and saying, yeah, this is something that happened and something that I am willing to talk about and acknowledge. And I think it's actually very healthy.
Does it surprise you that we're still talking about this as a taboo subject? I mean, it seems like it's been at least 15 years since people the likes of Mike Wallace came out and said, yeah, I have to take medication for my depression.
Yeah, it's easy for a famous person.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, I do think it is great to have celebrities, but somehow someone who's already achieved that level of that fame and late in their career, I think it's a lot easier. I mean, there's still issues of employment discrimination, for example. There's still issues of people feeling that others will think less of them if they tell that they've had experiences with depression. Sometimes these ideas are not true. I mean, I found that in talking to others about my experiences, that people still respect me, that I still respect myself, and that it's been very healthy. I've been able to connect with others who've gone through similar experiences. But nevertheless, I don't think things have changed yet from where they were when I was in the hospital with depression 20 years ago.
You use the language of epidemic for depression. It's right there in the subtitle of the book, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. But that is still a source of some controversy, it seems. So what do you say to people who say that we have simply lowered the definition and made it easier to consider something depression?
Well, there are some frightening statistics that really should get people's attention. So worldwide, suicide kills 1 million people a year. and one of the main contributing factors is depression in the U.S. Suicide kills 30,000 people a year. I mean, I think it should be zero. Why we tolerate this, I don't understand. It's the second leading cause of death in young people. And again, one of the main reasons that we see such high suicide rates is that people feel that they can't get help, that they can't admit that they have a problem, or it's so shameful to go into treatment that they don't stay in treatment. And so you may have seen stories about military suicides. So the military has all these programs designed to enable veterans to go into treatment and stay in treatment. But again, the stigma of depression is so powerful that even with these well-designed programs, we still have these terrible suicides and people coming back from wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Jonathan, you say depression sufferers face two trials. Which two? I mean, the depression itself would seem to be one.
Sure. One trial is that severe depression is terribly debilitating, and the symptoms are awful. You can't sleep. You can't eat. You're not at home with yourself. The other trial is that, at least in our society, you often have to conceal this problem, and you have to deal with how other people are reacting to this problem. So other people might tell you that you're weak or that you need to do this, you need to do that, and give you all sorts of unwanted advice that is sometimes as bad as the depression itself.
The old buck-up cure, that sort of thing?
That's right.
Yeah. All right, let's talk more about that when we come back from a break. Jonathan Rottenberg, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Back with Jonathan Rottenberg and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is depression, specifically depression as it relates to evolution. It may be that what we know as depression was actually developed over the eons and over the species to give us a leg up evolutionarily. Jonathan Rottenberg, an associate professor of psychology at the University of South Florida, explains this in his book, The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. You can join this conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, our local number is 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about the two trials of depression sufferers. Number one is the depression itself. Number two is the having to hide it. Is that still a fairly common thing, though? Not only the hiding part, but the fact is that people say, come on, snap out of it, feel better, go to a movie, you know. Real snappy, easy advice that really isn't that easy.
It really is. Again, nothing has changed since when I was in the hospital 20 years ago. If someone gets in a car accident and is in bed because they injured their back, other people rush in with a casserole. How can I help? Someone is in bed because of depression. No one knows what to say. No one knows what to do. We still have this kind of paralysis around depression that we don't have for other problems. I think it's very real and really needs to change.
Yeah, and among the attitudes, you point out that there is no race for the cure for depression. There's lots of meds, though. I mean, lots and lots of medications. How effective are any of those?
Our treatments are all better than nothing, and I'm not advising anyone to go off their medication suddenly. But about two-thirds of people who take medications still experience some degree of symptoms. So these are all far from a cure. Some people have very good results, but your mileage may vary. Antidepressants have been around for almost 60 years, and there are 26 different antidepressants, and yet the process of finding one that will work for a given individual is really trial and error in a slow and sometimes very frustrating process for people.
And there's also cognitive behavioral therapy seems to be pretty hot at the moment, CBT. How is that generally being used to help depression sufferers?
So because mood has many different sources, and one of those sources are people's thoughts, cognitive behavioral therapy helps people to identify problematic thoughts. And in the therapy, they literally will review the sorts of thoughts that you're having, give you homework where you can observe the kinds of thoughts you're having and make an effort to try to change them, and particularly negative thoughts. So thoughts that you're a terrible person or that nothing good will possibly happen to you. And in fact, changing those thoughts works about as well as medications for most people.
There's a fair number of case histories in here, and as you point out, most of the names have been changed to protect identities here. But you do quote from one sufferer who says, and I quote, "It sucks, but there's value in it." Value in depression for what?
Well, depression is what we make of it in terms of severe depression, where I clearly think that there is value, evolutionary value, is in low mood as an adaptation. So the only way we can understand depression is that we go and understand why we have moods. We're beasts, and that we've been endowed both with high moods, and you could easily see how high moods would help us pursue rewards more efficiently, so we make hay when the sun shines. But low moods, too, are useful. They're useful in helping us pause our behavior when we're in dangerous or difficult situations. You know, if you're in the middle of a blizzard, it's not a good idea to go strike out on a new trail. And so, too, when we're engaged in ventures that are not paying off, so when I say we, I mean we and other animals. So think of a bear fishing for salmon in your neck of the woods, right? So they've been fishing all day, no salmon. A bear that just keeps fishing in the same place, wasting effort, may starve. So we need a mechanism that helps us stop what we're doing, stay in place, and consider an alternative behavior, and that's low mood.
But in the case of the bear fishing and not having success, or the not willing to strike out in a blizzard to get someplace, is that necessarily driven by mood or just more by the reality of the situation? Like, well, this doesn't work, therefore I shall stop and do something different.
Well, the animal needs a psychological mechanism, an internal mechanism to recognize what the situation is and what it needs to do. So it's not an automatic thing that an animal knows what to do. So moods tell us what we need to do. If we didn't have them, we literally would. The bear literally would have starved if it didn't have that behavioral mechanism to say, hey, you need to try something different.
All right, so it becomes a trigger to change behavior then. I mean, you realize this,
exactly.
This is not working for me. Okay.
Really, it's the same as that we experience anxiety to avoid threats. You know, we experience pain to help us avoid damage to our bodies. So these are usually very useful, but none of these adaptations are perfect. And we have people running around with crippling anxiety and crippling pain, but we don't think it's a good idea to be born without the capacity for pain. In fact, we know that people who are born with congenital lack of pain live shorter lives. They break bones, they get burns. It's useful to recognize when you've been injured.
You point out you not only want to adjust the therapies for depression, but the diagnosis itself. What do you think we have wrong right now in diagnosing depression?
Well, procedurally, it's usually very hasty. You know, often it can be based on a 5-minute visit with a general practitioner who may not, I have a great respect for GPs, but they may not have extensive training in mental health. And often people don't get a very detailed assessment of what their symptoms are and what's going on in their life. And so it's often a very casual process, and I think that's unfortunate.
You have just talked about depression as a mood disorder. I mean, really, how much do we know about moods, though? I mean, is there adequate research on this, do you think, too?
We know a lot. And one reason that mood is a really valuable approach to understanding depression and the depression epidemic is that we know that there are a lot of things that are affecting moods. So when I say we're beasts and we need to understand moods because of that evolutionary history, we're a very special kind of beast. And so we've created a very unique kind of physical and cultural environment that's very hospitable for low mood. For example, we don't get enough sleep. We know that sleep is vital to having a sense of well-being. We don't get enough light. People live indoors. They're often relying on artificial lighting. We also know that mood is pretty responsive to physical activity and that in modern life, we tend not to get, on average, enough physical activity. So we know that there are a lot of things that humans are doing right now in our environment that are really not very good for mood. It's sort of a poor climate for mood. In some ways, we're creating the perfect storm for mood.
And yet, in the examples you gave, which would be human beings or any species for that matter, choosing not to wander out in a blizzard because the mood tells you, you know, this is just, it's a good place to stay put, or the low mood of the bear searching for salmon and not getting any and thinking, okay, this isn't working. if a low mood is realistic, when you flip that coin over, then is a good mood naive or blinded?
That's a really good point. And in fact, there are some people who argue that, you know, people who are psychologically healthy are systematically ignoring a lot of realities. So, you know, every day you see on the news terrible stories about people dying of famine. In fact, we all know that we're all mortal. We're going to die. Psychological health, in some sense, is having some illusions. Illusions are, in some ways, protective.
Jonathan Rottenberg is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of South Florida, the Director of the Mood and Emotion Laboratory, and the author of the book The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. So what we know as depression now could be something that we adapted to make sure that our species survived through the eons. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about depression and evolution. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So the very physical examples, we've been working with here, which are more environmental. I mean, given the kind of world we live in now, I mean, are we living with depression as a natural response to an environment that we largely no longer deal with?
Yes, there's sort of a mismatch between this adaptation and the environment that we're in. And I described, you know, some physical aspects of the environment. So we're not getting enough sleep, we're not getting enough light, for example. But there's also psychological aspects of the environment that are uniquely human. I think that depression is actually worse in humans than it is in other species. And it's ironic because it's not because humans are in some ways a uniquely defective species, but it's really because of things that humans do kind of too well. So, for example, we're the only species that has very advanced language and has a very elaborate kind of conceptual self. So we tell stories about ourselves. We kind of are a hero or a villain in our own movie that's kind of running in our head. So, you know, a chimpanzee, I believe, can feel bad, but only a human being can feel bad about feeling bad and kind of play this movie over and over in its head. And I think that's one of the kind of amplifiers of the depression epidemic is human language in how we tell stories about ourselves.
So in essence, it's almost like we have too much brain. We're intellectualizing our moods?
Right. So, you know, a chimpanzee can't have the thought, I'm a terrible mother. They just don't have those thoughts. They don't have life stories, right? And many times, depression is about a life story. So, for example, in my depression, I was having trouble functioning, and I had this very ambitious goal of becoming a historian and getting a PhD. I had the story that I was going to fail as a historian, right? And that story was going over in my head over and over again, and in some sense, I couldn't stop myself from thinking. So thinking and human varieties of thinking are one of the... It's kind of a minefield because, you know, we use thinking to solve problems, but this kind of repetitive, kind of almost violent thinking turning inward upon yourself is one of the real dangers that comes out of human uniqueness.
In discussions about depression, we often get into this realm of trying to figure out whether it is simply a chemical imbalance and it just comes on out of nowhere or whether it is a response. You're suggesting it's always response-based, or is that not necessarily what you're thinking?
Well, I think that mood has many sources, right? And sometimes, and we're always trying to tell ourselves a story about why we're in a mood, the mood that we're in. And sometimes we don't get very far and we need to see a psychotherapist and they can help us. Many depressions do have obvious environmental antecedents or precipitants. So people lose their job, their marriage dissolves. Something really very serious happens that affects their well-being. But you're right, in other cases, it's more subtle. And in the book, I talk a lot about how low mood, which has many, many sources, sometimes can get amplified into a really significant depression without a major environmental insult. And this, too, I think is one way in which humans are different from cats and dogs, which I think that it's much harder for them to become depressed without a major event happening.
Let's take some phone calls here. We have Jacob and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Jonathan Rottenberg is the author of The Depths.
Hi, good morning. I have a comment regarding the history of depression and subsequently a future proposal to cure it. But I would say there's a saying that idle hands are the devil's work, meaning if you have time, you know, for leisure, you have free time, you can actually develop melancholia, you know, where you, like your guest is saying, overthink, you know, actions and second-guess yourself. And I think we have more of that in a modern era where we actually have post-industrialization and in industrial agriculture where people are not preoccupied with surviving. You know, we don't have sustenance farming anymore, foraging, trying to struggle to stay warm in the wintertime.
Yeah, we're not like the bear trying to catch the salmon.
Yeah, but if we were busier, if we had things to do with our hands, if we had busy work, I think that's the cure for a lot of people with depression. If they have a hobby where they can get preoccupied and keep their hands busy, whether knitting or woodwork or something, or, you know, maybe trying to raise a kid or having a puppy at home, you tend to not be depressed because you're too busy to be depressed, okay? But I have a cure for depression. The interesting thing is placebos have up to 40% cure rate for depression, you know, when they give placebos and they give the antidepressants. And we know what cures depression right now. We've got a very cheap, powerful drug, you know, like Prozac.
Mm-hmm.
If we put Prozac in the water, it'd be almost like, you know, putting fluoride in the water to prevent dental caries, you know, for dental health. Mental health is just as important. If you put Prozac in the water, you get good mental health. But even if we don't put Prozac in the water, we pretend to put Prozac in the water, people who drink water will think they'll get better too.
Huh.
So, you know, it sounds stupid, but you either put Prozac in the water or threaten to put Prozac in the water, and people will actually get better.
Yikes, tricky proposition in a time when people resist putting fluoride in the water, but we'll take it from there, Jacob. Thanks for the call. Thoughts, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, I think Jake makes a good point that it's too simple to think of depression in terms of a simple defect in your brain. I mean, he's pointing to some environmental changes that have happened since in the last 10,000 years with widespread agriculture and usually people having enough food to eat, although that, you know, is not always true, in that with our being able to take care of our basic needs very often, it does in some sense create a space for this kind of mental rumination or repetitive thought that can be a risk for depression.
Let's take another call. Here's Helga in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Jonathan Rottenberg, the author of The Depths.
Hi. I want to bring up, you talked about storytelling affecting our moods. Well, there are times when I just have to turn off the national news on the radio because what the stories that they are telling about dreadful things that are going on everywhere and how people can't work things out just affect me. And no, there's too little talk about how to solve things. You know, oh, we have environmental crisis, this is happening, that's happening. But I know people have figured out ways of dealing with it, but that isn't talked about. So it almost feels like the media, the national media, is trying to get our mood down, and I wonder if they're trying to get us to be helpless.
Interesting thought. Thanks for that, Helga. Appreciate it. Jonathan?
Well, I think it's always been the case that the national media, you know, in the U.S., we'll talk about more about a bad thing happening, a murder, a suicide, than someone helping a nice old lady off across the street. But I think one place where the media plays a huge role, and it's more subtle, is in adjusting what we think we should be feeling. So we live in a culture where we have very high expectations for how happy. We should be. There's this whole industry of self-help books that says, you know, read this book and you're going to be blissfully happy. People go on social media and see the pictures of people on vacation all smiling, and we're all kind of outdoing one another. And there's a lot of social comparison that goes on, but this is really not very realistic. What we know from evolution is that we're not really designed to be blissfully happy all the time. I mean, evolution is much more interested in survival than in happiness, but we've become sort of less able to tolerate unhappiness, and in part I do blame the media for it.
Well, all right, we can argue about whether it's the media or the consumption of it, but we have to take a break and we'll come back and pick it up there. The Depths, the Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic is the book. Jonathan Rottenberg from the University of South Florida, our guest. We'll come back and talk more with Jonathan. Take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jonathan Rottenberg, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of South Florida. He's the director of the Mood and Emotion Laboratory there. And he's written a book connecting depression to evolution, that what we know as depression now is something that really might have helped us survive through the eons and through the various twists and turns we took as a species. The book is called The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. You can join our discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to that previous discussion about the media and the perceptions, and sometimes it's not just the news, but just, for example, the Pepsi commercials, mm-hmm. with these people having outrageously good times. It seems like in an age of social media as well, when we see all those people snapping all those smiling selfies and having great times over beef and lunch or whatever, that maybe there's a new way for us to get ourselves into low moods by seeing other people having good times that we know, as opposed to the people in the Pepsi commercials.
I think that's very true. We're sort of encouraged to imagine that if we don't feel blissfully happy, if we don't feel wonderful, that there must be something wrong with us. We're not sort of part of the party. And I think what's happening often is that people are thinking, there must be something wrong with me. Repeating that thought over and over is, again, an amplifier, how low mood can turn into something more serious. So these high standards that we have for happiness that you're talking about being in commercials or being on social media, they may seem benign, but I don't think they are benign. I think they're very unrealistic.
Let's take another call. We have Scott in Talent on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. If I can ever get this button pushed. Boy, it's really a hard one today. There we go.
Hi.
Jonathan Rottenberg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Scott, welcome with Jonathan Rottenberg.
Hi, thanks. While I was waiting on hold, I just remembered a Prairie Home Companion from a few years ago, and it was either Garrison Keillor or one of his characters who stated that the reason that most people are depressed is because they can't be rich and famous. And I don't know if it's true or not, but anyway, my comment was I'm trying to reconcile one of the main points of the evolutionary aspect, and the author is claiming that animals and people use depression, or depression causes people to change what they're doing so that they can be successful. But I'm trying to reconcile it because in all of my experience in seeing depressed people and in being depressed and in seeing like depressed animals, dogs and horses, what I see and what seems to be axiomatic is that depression doesn't cause you to change. It saps your motivation and causes you to not want to do anything. So when I think of a bear who can't catch a fish, I don't see a bear who says, well, I'm going to go try somewhere else. I'm just going to sit down here because it's all worthless. So I wonder if he could explain that.
All right. Yeah. What good does lying in bed do us? Thanks for that, Scott. Appreciate it.
Well, again, I'm certainly not I'm advising that we try to reduce the amount of severe depression that we have, because I don't think that it's always helping people. I think that these mechanisms that we have for low mood in the modern environment are producing low moods that are going on for too long. Someone who's depressed for 20 years, I really don't think that's producing an adaptive outcome for that person, or the person who's so depressed that they have constant suicidal thoughts. Right, so they're taking it's a perfectly good adaptation, and that doesn't mean that it's in every case helping the person. So I think that's an important clarification.
All right. I want to get to some of the triggers, though, because you have a whole section here on death as a trigger. I mean, is it fair to call us all depressed in grief, or are we just sad? And I guess that brings up the larger question. What's the difference between deep sadness and depression?
Yeah, so grief is a perfect example. So when someone important dies, most people pause what they're doing, and they focus on the death and what it means to them, what it means to their future. They go to others for support. And I think this is perfectly adaptive, but for a time, people often act in a way would be distressing. I mean, they have a lot of symptoms. Now, serious loss is also a precipitant for clinical depression. For most people, the death resolves itself. We have rituals surrounding grief. It's very socialized, so we're comfortable talking about a death usually. And we have funerals, and people come over, and again, they bring casseroles to sort of soothe the mourners. So this is a way in which a person can realize, well, after they've had a period of grieving, they can resume their life. The loss has been acknowledged, and they can move on. Now, people have other kinds of losses. Right, they may have lost their job, for example, or they may have lost their marriage, but because there isn't the same kind of rituals around those losses, often those can lead, in fact, more often, lead to serious depressions. Depression often involves the theme of loss.
But people do certainly grieve at their own rates. You know, everybody grieves differently. You know, one person may seem to bounce back to quote unquote normal after a few weeks or months. Other people may take a few years. Given those differences that just range from person to person, I mean, are we really comfortable in saying, okay, this is depression, this is just their grieving?
Yeah, I think it can be a fine line where does low mood become so debilitating? So I think if the person has if it's been going on for many months, if the person has suicidal thoughts, if the person's lost a huge amount of weight, things like that, those are warning signs that the person might actually need, independent of the loss, that they might need help. And in fact, I think that the grieving process doesn't always take care of itself, and sometimes it does need some help.
All right. I want to come back. We were talking about the thinking brain versus the emoting brain, and the fact is that we can think about things that may actually trigger into depression. On the other hand, though, I mean, is there any help about thinking our way out of low moods? Is the emotion part of the brain pretty much immune to the thinking part of the brain? I mean, basically, is it just our brain telling us to buck up, and we don't take it from outsiders, we're not going to take it from ourselves either?
No, I think that there's a lot that people can do to sort of be more skeptical about their own thoughts and to think about their goals. So your caller said with the Garrison Keillor quote that people were becoming depressed because they had, you know, very extreme goals, that they were not famous, that they had not become a doctor or a lawyer and become wealthy, for example. But goals are something that we can change. And people who have a variety of goals that are achievable often will do better than someone who has one massive goal that's extremely, hard to fulfill. And I can say this from my personal experience. When I had my depression, really my main goal in life was to become a historian. And when that didn't work out, I had no fallback. I had no sort of other sources for my esteem. But the good news is that you actually can, it's hard, but you can reformulate your goals. And I would, you know, welcome people to think about that.
I don't quite have the full quote here, but you say in essence in the book, the purpose of deep depression is to organize disengagement. What does that mean?
Well, so for example, think about people who are in a famine, and there's no food. There's very little that you can do. Very commonly, and they've seen this in human beings who experimentally were exposed to deprivation of food, that a very high percentage of them developed depression. I don't think this is random. The depression is there to make sure that they don't waste effort so they actually live longer. I think that this response, the evolution intended it to be used relatively sparing. I guess how often are there serious famines? But it's not a random response. It's not random what people don't do. It's very organized. It's very systematic. So people, they behave less. They have certain thoughts about that they can't do things. And that's why it can be so difficult to overcome. So, for example, when you have the thought, you can't get out of bed, right? It's not just an idle thought. There's a lot of emotion behind it, and people who are in depression have this experience of being trapped. That's what I mean by organized disengagement.
And then you were just talking about people who actually, in an experimental basis, did get deprived of food. Are we talking about Dr. Ansel Keys and his starvation experience? Yeah. So what happened there? That's a really, really interesting and not comfortable to talk about set of experiments.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So this was during World War II. They had a number of people who were conscientious objectors to the war, so they didn't go to fight, but they contributed to science by going to the University of Minnesota and living kind of underneath the football stadium. And they were interested in not to just torture people, but to understand how you could refeed people after the war, because they knew that the war was creating incredible famine in Europe. So the phase of the experiment, they literally starved people, and then there was a phase of the experiment where they refed people, and they were trying to figure out how do we refeed them, how rapidly do we refeed them. One of the sort of unintended findings, one of the things that they learned, was that a high percentage of the people, these men who were the conscientious objectors in this study, they became depressed. They became very depressed, even though they knew what they were doing was right, that it was helping their country, that they were learning about science and so forth, that for many of them it was difficult for them to finish the study.
Did the depression pretty well track with the famine they experienced? I mean, you know, the more depressed they were, the more starved they were?
Yes, it was progressive, and it actually, this is an interesting thing, it didn't turn on a dime. So some of the men still had some problems even after they started to refeed them, and they actually sort of accelerated that phase of the experiment. And that's something that's very true of significant depression, that even if good things happen, a person, it tends to take a while for this kind of the mood system to correct itself. It might take some weeks. It may take some months, and that's what happened for these men too.
We had talked way early in the discussion about suicide rate among veterans, I think. And so, how do your findings explain the suicide rate, for example, among veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars? That's an email from Debbie in Talent.
I think that's a great question. That's not something that I've devoted study to specifically, but I would hypothesize that for many of these people, it may involve that they have lost a sense of purpose. They've also been exposed, many of them, to very traumatic events. So the combination of those two things, so that they've seen things that are very, very hard to deal with, that are very upsetting, and they've come back to civilian life, and they don't know how they're going to be integrated. They don't know what they're going to do. Those two things on top of one another create a situation that's going to be a breeding ground for PTSD and for depression as well.
Jonathan Rottenberg, what was the experiment you did at Stanford with depressed people and films? This is really interesting stuff.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so when I was getting started as a graduate student, we didn't have the knowledge that we do now about emotions in depression. And what we thought then was that people who are depressed are going to be very responsive to sad things. So, for example, if you show a sad film to depressed people, they're going to be really likely to cry to it and have these very pronounced crying episodes and have all these changes in their body. And so we did an experiment that at the time, you know, I had some trepidations about, you know, is it immoral to show depressed people a sad film? But what we found was that not only were depressed people not any more likely to cry to the sad film than were non-depressed people, they actually had diminished reactions. So they had less increase in their heart rate. They had less sweating on their hands. So the normal physiological responses that people have to crying, depressed people had less of those. And this is sort of the notion that depression, what it does is it flattens the emotional landscape. So whatever the situation, the person, you know, reports feeling sad and doesn't show a whole lot of behavior, doesn't show a whole lot of response. So this is one of the early studies that really got us thinking about a new way of thinking about emotions and depression.
So essentially, they've been turned into a series of shades of gray, it sounds like, rather than the brighter colors that we tend to know of emotions. What do we do with the information you're giving us here, though? I mean, as we read the depths and think about evolution and depression, I mean, what could we possibly do with the information that would change our approach to how we treat depression?
I actually think that the book, even though it's hard to critique what we're doing as wrong, has a lot of very optimistic messages. Because mood is the great integrator, it takes what's going on on our body, what's going on in our thoughts, and what's going on in our environment, and kind of fuses all those things together. There's a variety of ways that people can actually improve their mood. They can change what goals they're having. They can change their sleep routines. They can change how much light they're getting and how much physical activity they're getting. They absolutely can take medications. They absolutely can have cognitive behavioral therapy. And so the mood approach is, in a sense, much more open to the variety of sources that we know actually do affect moods in people. So people don't have to rely on a single point of salvation, and I think this is very important.
Well, certainly a lot to digest in the book. It is called The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Jonathan Ruttenberg is a professor of psychology, associate professor of psychology at the University of South Florida. Jonathan, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
You bet. That'll do it for today's exchange. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the very different interchange coming to Interstate 5 at Phoenix and what makes it very different. We'll talk about the grape harvest in California and what that means for all sorts of things. Then we'll talk about war versus diplomacy with a person who gets involved in that discussion on a daily basis. That's all tomorrow on The Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow at 8 on another edition of The Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Have a great day.